You're listening to KXRY Portland on 107.1 FM, 91.1 FM, and streaming online at xray.fm. I'm Sarika Mehta. Welcome to Intersections Radio, a new independent podcast which also airs on X-Ray. Intersections Radio is the show where we geek out on all things intersectionality. One of the topics I've been exploring on this show is the relationship between the police and people of color with disabilities, and why these stories rarely, if ever, show up in the media. For this episode, I spoke with Chicago-based journalist David Perry. He's the co-author of the Ruderman White Paper on media coverage of law enforcement use of force and disability, which was just published last week. David Perry is also a professor of medieval history at Dominican University. His young son has Down syndrome. Over the past 4 years, David has been focusing more on issues of disability. Many of the unarmed young Black men who were shot by police over the past 3 years, in fact, had disabilities. But these facts were never mentioned in press coverage. Or if they were, they were glossed over or presented in a negative manner. This includes the reporting of Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, and many others. David and I met on Skype to discuss these issues. This is the first of a continuing discussion on this topic. This is Intersections Radio. David Perry, thank you so much for joining me on Intersections Radio. The topic is the white paper published by the Ruderman Foundation, and the issue is media coverage of police brutality against people with disabilities, police brutality in law enforcement. Give us some more background on this paper, the data and the case studies that were used to put together this research.
So the Ruderman Foundation is focused on inclusion and over the years has worked very actively in fairly traditional disability rights spaces like education and work and housing. And it's become clear to them, as to a lot of people, that as we've had this national conversation about policing, that disability is a major part of it, that many, many of the victims whose names we've heard were in fact disabled, but that generally people around the country, not in the disability community, are unaware of that fact. So they were looking for a way to bring disability into the conversation and turned to me and my co-writer, Lawrence Carter Long. Lawrence is a veteran of working on issues related to disability in the media in lots of different ways. And I've been writing specifically about policing and disability for about 3 years in various mass media contexts. So the three of us came together, the foundation, and then Lawrence and me, we came together to try to find a pathway to make this much more visible to the broader public. And we decided to work on the media. It's just one white paper. It's about 12,000 words. It's a huge topic. I'm actually writing a book about this topic. So we thought we'd just pick the media and look at the last 3 years as a way of saying, what is the conversation around disability and policing, and what are people doing well, what's being missed, and in what ways is the media perhaps actually harming the issue?
What are some of the major highlights, the major findings from this paper?
Well, there's a couple different major things. So first of all, in general, our coverage of policing in all cases has certainly gotten much richer and more common in the media since Ferguson. So that's about 2 years now or a little more. Journalists have learned how to write about policing. They've learned how to write about police issues. They've learned about use of force continuums. And in general, coverage of policing, there's just a lot more of it and it's a lot better. That means that the incidents involving people with disabilities are getting covered much more now than they were 3 years ago, that there was about 40 or 50 cases that we tracked in 2013 as opposed to around 400 in 2015. So that's a big jump, and I think that is not a coincidence. That said, the disability components are not being covered particularly better now than they were in 2013. There's a little more fluency in issues related specifically to mental illness, but we are always concerned about the tendency of the press to pathologize. So when disability is involved, they pathologize the disability, they treat it as an individual medical problem, and even sometimes link the negative outcomes, which is to say death or injury at the hands of police, to the presence of mental illness. So there's plenty of coverage or more coverage of the cases, but not especially sophisticated coverage when it comes to disability. And in some cases, when the disability is not something fairly obvious, like bipolar disorder is involved, it just gets missed or dropped out or put as kind of an afterthought. And there isn't a lot of questioning of why so many victims of police violence are disabled. And that's the other major finding. We are convinced that a third to a half of all victims of police violence, even that may be the wrong phrase, a third to a half of all people who are killed by law enforcement, sometimes in horrific illegal ways, sometimes in quite likely justified ways, but a third to a half of all people who are killed by law enforcement are disabled. And that's a pretty big number. It's only if we can only say a third to a half because people aren't tracking the data, and that's another one of the findings. We need much better data. We need every use of force by a police officer, really, we should track, and we should track it based on race and by class and by geographic location, but yes, also by disability, so we have a better sense of what's really happening out there.
Exactly. The numbers were much more jarring than I think I anticipated. And that's as somebody who also works in the field of covering issues concerning people with disabilities, that a third to a half, that's a gigantic number. And you brought up a couple of other issues. One being that if there is a disability and if it's not that obvious or visible, or even if it is, it's hardly mentioned in the reporting. Or another issue you talked about in the paper is that the victim is blamed. Why is this the case? Or rather, I should say, why is the reporting done in this manner?
Well, I think there's a lot of confusion about how to talk about disability in general among the American public. That the notion of disability as a social problem, that people are disabled by a society that doesn't know how to accommodate people, versus disability being an individual problem that needs to be fixed, or actually in the words of Jay Ruderman, too many people see disability as a charity, that we have to go help someone who is other than us, as opposed to as an issue of inclusion, that we need to bring everything together, that we need to alter society as a way to make it more inclusion, that not only will people with disabilities benefit, but we will all benefit from a more inclusive society. That's actually, although fairly a comfortable idea, I think, in the disability rights world, is still a pretty strange idea, not just in general in the public, but even in the nonprofit world and the charity world, that you might think about the people you're working with as equals, as full members of society, as opposed to as this unfortunate person. It's a strange issue in the journalistic world, and even in the journalism world, where the reporters are used to dealing with other kinds of social justice issues, reporters who are very sophisticated talking about race, class, gender, sexual identity, other kinds of major identity issues that cause marginalization, in which there are individual forms of oppression as well as systematic oppression. People who are very good about that still haven't quite caught up on kind of best thinking about disability in the disability rights world. And so journalists who are not disability rights experts are reflecting that lack of sophistication.
And this relates to another question, talking about the language that's used by journalists in reporting these stories, or even in writing in-depth pieces, by saying somebody was suffering from X condition or afflicted with Y condition. And another point that you brought up, which I really liked, was that we need to call it what it is, which is disability. Terms like special needs, you know, there's nothing special about not wanting to get shot. Can you comment on this further?
Yeah. So my friend and co-writer, Lawrence Carter Long, is the founder of the Say the Word hashtag, which just says, say the word disability. He's not especially worried about identity first, disabled person versus person first, person with disability, although he uses identity first language, but he just wants us to say the word disability. It's the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's not the Americans with Special Needs Act. Disability is a class of individuals with legal protections and powers. It is a powerful word, and we just need to say it and stop using euphemisms. So I wholeheartedly agree with him, but I want to give credit where it's due, that he's really pushing this very hard. Suffer is the number one word I would like reporters in particular to take out of their language. And if they quote someone who says it, to do so very judiciously and very thoughtfully. We cannot assume that someone is suffering from their disability. sometimes suffering does happen, but the assumption that to be disabled is to be suffering, I think, is, if I could change one thing in all of American journalism involving disability, that is the number one thing I would start with. Because it's a very different statement to say, to take a real example, Eric Garner was suffering from asthma, or Kajime Powell was suffering from bipolar disorder, both of these individuals killed by police, rather than to say Eric Garner had asthma, Kajime Powell had bipolar disorder. When you say suffers from, it implies that the disability was responsible for the tragic outcome. And as I said, as you quote, it's not a special need to not want to be shot by police. And what Kajime Powell suffered from in the end were bullets in his body. And what Eric Garner suffered from in the end was a hand, an arm across his throat. Those are the things that they suffered from at the moment of death, not from their disability.
This is very interesting because it brings about a different nuance to whether it's that people feel about what people feel about PC language, politically correct language, or unbiased reporting. This is very interesting.
Yeah, I do think it feeds into, again, issues that we have much more sophistication on generally across the media landscape than we do about disability. But it's important to remember, I'm not blaming reporters for not being sophisticated on these ideas that are very new, even within the community itself. Although the disability rights, the modern disability rights movement, certainly has history that goes back at least into the 50s and 60s, a lot of these identity issues have really only come into the fore in the last 20 or 30 years. The academic side of it, which certainly is a pushing component where you have disabled scholars studying disability studies, although, again, there are precursors, and I don't want anyone to get mad at me to sort of put it recently, but in many ways, as a field, the identity side of disability studies dates back to the 90s. It's still a very young movement and a very young field. And the notion that disability is an identity that stretches across categories of medical diagnosis, that there are similarities in identity between wheelchair users, between people who are blind or deaf, between people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, breaking down these hierarchies is an aggressive new idea that's building new communities. And journalists, especially the beat reporter who covers, you know, W9 News in whatever town or city you are, those beat reporters are not going to be at the leading edge of identity and of language, but they do need to catch up because in the meantime, people are being killed by their local police. And so we need them to report this in ways that reflect our better understandings.
That's a very good point. And actually, it was a good segue to my next question. One of the pressing points I really want to talk about is that these are, as you had mentioned, these are intersectional issues, that these cover issues of race and class, sexuality, and disability, and et cetera. And that several of the unarmed young Black men that were gunned down that you talk about in your report had disabilities, but this was not reported at all. I mean, I didn't even realize that these people had disabilities. Talk about
the amazing thing, right? That both people who are deeply connected to disability rights world and people who are deeply connected to the Black Lives Matter movement are unaware of these intersections that, you know, we don't know about any disabilities related to Michael Brown. But after Michael Brown, Kajime Powell was disabled, Tamir Rice was disabled, Eric Garner was disabled, Freddie Gray was disabled, Sandra Bland was disabled. These names that have rung out across our activist and media landscapes, these powerful names of victims who have made us so angry but also inspired protests but movements. So many of these names are both Black and disabled. And we haven't really, not just in the media, but in activist communities, wrestled with those intersections. And we hope that this white paper is a pathway to begin to think about the ways in which racism, individual racism and structural racism, intersect with ableism. Both, again, individual ableism, an individual cop who responds negatively to someone who is disabled because they're disabled, as well as structural ableism, the ways in which our society disadvantages people with disabilities and places them in vulnerable positions. And what we know from studying discrimination is that when you have someone who is multiply marginalized, who has more than one category of marginalization, those stories of marginalizations interact with each other, intersect with each other, and exponentially increase the likelihood of tragic outcomes. So race, class, and disability. If you have a homeless person who is an African-American and disabled, that homelessness is going to propel them into constant contact with the police. The race may make the police officer more likely to think that they are likely to be violent and to be more likely to use force. Their disability may mean that they're less likely to comply with police commands. And so, again, police are going to escalate. Race, class, and ability, and gender, too, all coming together to make that one individual, and we have seen these individuals, Africa or Charlie, who was a homeless man, African-American homeless man with bipolar disorder, was killed in Skid Row in L.A. last year. They come together in him and mean that his encounter with the police is just much more likely to result in something tragic than another encounter.
You had brought up the issue, you had brought up Black Lives Matter as a movement. This question is a little bit off the topic of media coverage, just for a moment, as you're somebody with expertise in this area and reporting. So these tragedies of police shootings and the lack of indictments have kind of paved the way for the Black Lives Matter movement. Do you feel that the movement has addressed these intersectional issues, has addressed people with disabilities, and how, as you mentioned, for example, this homeless African-American person with a disability, how they're going to be much more in touch with police presence? Do you feel that the movement has addressed these issues, or how do you feel about that?
I think the movement, as with most police reform movements, has done a lot of talking about mental illness and has looked at mental illness as an issue and has worked to try to suss out some best practices as regards training police to handle people in mental health crisis better. There is a lot of room for both the disability rights movement and the Black Lives Matter movement to coordinate. I have to say that the disability rights movement needs to do a lot of work here, that in general, the disability rights movement, and I say this as a white, abled male, so I am talking to myself as well as to others, but our leaders tend to be, they tend to be neurotypical, they tend to be white, they tend to be upper class, and that they have, the disability movement needs to see the police violence issue as their movement, as our movement. And I do think that the Black Lives Matter movement would benefit from thinking about the intersections with ableism and moving away from a mental illness model to thinking about disability and thinking about structural ableism as opposed to about lack of medical health care. Though mental health care is important and medical care is often important, and that's not irrelevant. But I think that there are ways in which looking at the disability side of things might provide new insights and new approaches to police violence that would benefit everyone involved.
Definitely, definitely. So this paper was only just published, yesterday or today? So I'm curious, how have your field of journalists and law enforcement and the people who are directly affected, how has there been much response yet since it is so new, or how has the response been?
The first stage of response has been within the disability community. It has been generally very positive, and we're very grateful for the people who are reading it and sharing it. There have been stories in major publications and promises of more to come, and we hope that it helps shift thinking. I have to say that individually, when I have sat down and talked about it with reporters or with people who are working in law enforcement, there is a lot of surprise and then sort of a quick realization that just things, when you think about Eric Garner as a disabled man as well as a black man, and you realize, in the words of my co-writer Lawrence Carter Long, this is in the paper, but Eric Garner's last act as a living person was to ask for a reasonable accommodation, right? He says, "I can't breathe." He is asking the police at that moment to accommodate him by getting their hands off of his neck. That's his last act. When you start talking about the death of Eric Garner or many of these other tragic stories in this way, people have thought this is important. And when you start thinking about the difference between disability as illness, which we need to fix, and disability as disability, which we need to accommodate within our society, and you apply that to policing, people seem to find that very persuasive. So I'm happy with where it is right now. People are nervous, though, and I think not without reason, that talking about disability will be seen as a way to not talk about race. And I just want to say again, this is an intersectional Our aspirations are to see the ways in which racism and ableism, disabled people of color, even more vulnerable than they might be otherwise, and also present some possible solutions that thinking about disability might actually bring to the table, that bringing disability rights people into the conversation might bring new perspectives that could be very beneficial.
Exactly. This is just the tip of the iceberg, and we have many more conversations to come about these issues. Do you have any last remarks or topics that you want to discuss before we close?
Well, I do think that journalism matters, that you brought up politically correct language. You know, I do think that journalists really do shape the way we understand problems, that we understand who's responsible and what possible pathways forward there might be, that activist movements are right to push journalists to cover things differently, and that we need to continue to hold our journalists accountable and also support them and find ways to interact with them and to build trust between writers and activists and victims. And for that matter, we need to make sure that we are able to interrogate the perpetrators of this and understand what's going on there so that we can try to build better systems going forward, but also and also to hold people accountable. Language really matters. Journalism as a place where language happens really matters. And so, as you say, this is just a very first step. Despite these numbers, there's just not a lot out there that makes this case that disability is part of this conversation. And if all we accomplish is to say we need to think about disability in the context of police violence in the context of disability, we need to think about this as an inclusion issue, not a charity or special needs issue, then I'll be pretty happy with the impact of this paper and look forward to what other people take from it and do next.
I look forward to that too. David Perry, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on Intersections Radio, and we will have more conversations about this.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That was David Perry, journalist and co-author of the Ruderman White Paper on Media Coverage of Law Enforcement Use of Force and Disability. To access the paper, listen to the podcast, and read a transcript of this interview, visit the show's website at intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. Visit the same website for previous episodes of this podcast and join the Facebook family at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is Intersections Radio. Thanks for listening.